From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, America's new focus on Asia, running out of time in Europe, and the cost of helping the Arab Spring. President Obama spent the week traveling around the Pacific Rim, meeting Asian leaders and attending a series of regional conferences. His message throughout was the same. As the U.S. winds down its commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan, it will be shifting its attention to Asia, where there's both economic opportunity and potential security challenges. NPR's Anthony Kuhn covered the president's meetings in Bali, Indonesia. He says Asian leaders are divided about what to make of this new shift in U.S. focus.
The sound of Balinese gamelans wafts through a hotel lobby teeming with diplomats, bodyguards, and journalists. President Obama announced today that in a diplomatic breakthrough, he'll send Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to Myanmar next month. And U.S. efforts to ramp up engagement with China's neighbors have loomed over the proceedings here. This week, the U.S. also announced efforts to help beef up the tiny navy of the Philippines. That country is one of five embroiled in a territorial dispute with China over the South China Sea. Philippine presidential spokesman Ricky Carandang says his country needs a stronger military, but not just because of China.
When you go to the negotiating table with someone, you have to have at least the minimum deterrent capability. We need to build up our naval and military capabilities, not just because of this issue.
China has so far reacted mildly to the U.S.'s strategic shift. Many Chinese believe that the U.S. has tried to contain and encircle it for years, and previous American presidents have also pledged to step up engagement in Asia, so this is nothing new. Yuen Peng is an America expert at a government think tank in Beijing. He says the U.S. shift will merely aggravate China's tensions with its neighbors. The U.S. should first be considering how to deal with the region's major power, China, he says, rather than thinking how to use smaller countries to contain and stifle it. That Cold War mentality is not how the 21st century's major powers should interact. Most of China's neighbors try to balance relations between the region's main economic power, China, and the dominant military force, the U.S. Asian nations are divided over whether an increased U.S. presence in the region will bring stability or conflict. Indonesian Foreign Minister Marty Natalegawa says Asia must keep from becoming an arena for competition among the big powers.
It is not possible to wish away the influence of the bigger countries, but we can make a code of conduct within which countries carry on their activities in our region.
But among U.S. and Chinese policymakers, there's a strong current of realpolitik thinking, which you could sum up in the Chinese folk saying, one mountain isn't big enough for two tigers. University of Chicago political scientist John Mearsheimer views the U.S.'s strategic pivot towards Asia as an ominous move in a zero-sum contest between two hegemonic powers.
I think it's a major step forward in implementing a policy of containment. President Obama has said on this trip that the notion that we fear China is wrong. I think that's obviously not true. We fear China, and virtually all of China's neighbors in Asia fear it.
Our greatest unspoken fear, says Mearsheimer, is that China will eventually become powerful enough to station military forces in our backyard, much as the U.S. stations troops on China's doorstep in Japan and South Korea.
What we prefer is for China to be pinned down in Asia, worrying about the balance of power in its neighborhood. We do not want China to be free to roam. And of course, this is the principal reason that the United States will go to great lengths to make sure that China does not dominate Asia the way we dominate the Western Hemisphere.
He says the U.S. and China both feel they have little choice but to defend themselves against each other. But their defensive actions appear to the other side as hostile intent, leading to a self-fulfilling prophecy and an escalation of conflict. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Bali.
Coming up, running out of time in Europe and the cost of helping the Arab Spring. As the financial crisis in Europe continues, It's worth remembering what's at stake for the United States. The U.S. has trade ties with Europe going back centuries, so economic disaster there would have massive effects here. That's why U.S. officials are watching European efforts to scale back their debt crisis with great anxiety. They're worried that Europe's reforms will not come quickly enough. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports from Berlin.
Time and again, the financial markets have allowed Europe just enough time to come up with a seemingly endless series of minor incremental steps that fail to solve the crisis. But now that the debt crisis has rocked the Eurozone's third largest economy, a key question is whether time is finally running out. Political scientist Peter de Wilde is with Berlin's Social Science Research Center.
Whether these countries will default, will leave the Eurozone or not, it's all up for grabs. I mean, it seems that if there is a solution, it has to be a muddling through solution, but it's anybody's guess where this goes now.
Yet it's doubtful that muddling through, putting out one fire while another smolders, will continue to work.
Things will get much, much worse before they get better, if they do. Eventually, the difficult questions will need to have to be answered by democratic means.
Sony Kapoor with the London economics think tank Redefine says those big difficult questions include how and how quickly the Eurozone will move toward closer fiscal and political union. Will treaty changes happen to ensure that the economic and political fiasco occurring in Greece can never happen again, as well as questions about the role of the European Central Bank and structural reforms to promote growth?
The best we can hope for is that the crisis would have moved from the acute zone where things look like they may blow up any second to a more longer term problem where growth has slowed but important reforms are being taken and one can see the light at the end of the tunnel, which is not the case now.
In the post-war era, it's always taken a crisis to get European countries to cooperate more closely. But this debt crisis is proving more severe, longer lasting, and harder to solve than others, in part because of the European Union's weak central leadership. So de Wilde notes that has put pressure on the leaders of Germany and France, Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy, or Merkozy, as pundits now call the duo.
It's been difficult for them to present a tandem because France is obviously also in financial trouble. That means that it is clearly the most powerful European country in economic terms, Germany, that either steps up to the plate and takes leadership or allows Europe to falter.
Germany's chancellor has stepped up more of late to try to save the Eurozone from its existential funk. She's pressured Italy and Greece to stick to its reform pledges, and at the recent G20 summit, she raised the possibility of ejecting Greece from the Eurozone. But overall, many economists see Merkel's proposed solutions and her cautious, slow approach as inadequate. She's repeatedly drawn red lines, including rejecting the idea of collectivizing Eurozone debt through jointly issued Eurobonds. She's also fought against using the European Central Bank to buy up more bonds of debt-weakened countries. She wants more fiscal integration, but advocates moving slowly. EU treaties, she argues, should be changed before implementing new controls. Analyst Kapoor says the Eurozone doesn't have the luxury to wait.
The size of the economic problem is now so big that there is no longer a sensible solution possible within available political space. And this is where German red lines come in, which have effectively blocked any sensible economic solution that would work today.
There's also deep concern that Germany and its northern European allies continue to aggressively promote an austerity-first agenda. The only way out of the crisis, that theory goes, is to slash spending and benefits no matter how difficult. That proposed way out has only widened a north-south split and sparked unrest, as thousands in Greece and Spain in particular have taken to the streets to protest those painful cuts. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Berlin.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The Obama administration is trying to encourage democratic and economic reforms in the Middle East, building on the developments of the Arab Spring. But the U.S. doesn't have the resources it once had to offer something like the Marshall Plan that helped to rebuild Europe after World War II, or the large amounts of money that were invested in former communist countries after the end of the Cold War. So now the U.S. is focusing on trade rather than aid to help the Middle East. as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Just as the Arab uprisings were getting underway, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was warning that the region's foundations were sinking in the sand, that governments needed to respond to the needs of a young, educated, and underemployed generation. Now she's come up with a new catchphrase.
As tens of millions of young people enter the job market each year, we recognize that the Arab political awakening must also deliver an economic awakening. And we are working to help societies create jobs to ensure that it does.
Secretary Clinton has set up an office at the State Department to figure out ways to support the transitions in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. She tapped a veteran diplomat who has worked on reconstruction programs in the past. William Taylor recently told reporters that he recognizes today's budget constraints.
We had a lot more money to put into the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe. Today's fiscal situation is obviously different. But also, these countries need different things. That is, they need some things that we can provide in terms of trade.
Debt relief is another thing the U.S. can offer, Taylor says.
The Egyptians right now owe us about $1 billion in interest on previous loans. If the Congress agrees, then we will say to the Egyptians, don't send us that check. Keep that there. But we will agree with you. We, the United States government, will agree with you, the Egyptian government, on how to spend that $1 billion in Egypt.
These are good stopgap measures, says Michelle Dunn, who runs the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council.
We simply cannot give the kind of money that would make a big difference in these economies. The other things that we're doing, like debt relief, possible enterprise funds, are good. They can help in small ways, and they show support. But if you're talking about something that can really be an engine to pull big economies, like the economy of Egypt, for example, ahead, it has to be something like free trade with the United States and Europe.
The U.S. already has free trade agreements with Jordan and Morocco, and officials both here and in Europe have signaled they're ready to negotiate deals with future governments of countries now in transition. The president of the Maghreb Center here in Washington, Najib Ayachi, says the U.S. should also be encouraging countries in the region to trade more with each other.
The fact that these economies are not regionally integrated cost them something like 2 to 3% of GDP growth, according to some World Bank studies. We can use our leverage to encourage them to move on with the integration.
Negotiating trade deals, though, takes time and can't happen until these countries have their political houses in order. And while analysts are worried that the U.S. and Europe can't afford a new Marshall Plan for North Africa and the Middle East, Mohsen Khan of the Peterson Institute for International Economics says there are countries in the Arab world that can help.
This is a sort of unfortunate pun. If you could marshal them to provide the assistance, then the fact that you don't have the money to do it doesn't really matter because money is money. And they sure do need it.
So far, the grant money from the region hasn't flowed as quickly as needed, though. And economists don't see any quick fix to one of the main problems that sparked the uprisings in the Arab world, youth unemployment. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.